Chapter 32. The Austin Rover Roving. The basis for the Austin Rover, I learned much later, was a bus that the Goliath Corporation had bought in 1952 to transport its employees to the coast on work days out, a lamentable lapse in Goliath's otherwise fine record of rampant worker exploitation. The error was discovered after 8 years, and the day trips discontinued. True to form, Goliath docked the wages of all who attended and charged them for the trip, with backdated interest. The Austin Rover has two separate systems, explained Dr. Anne Worthless. The Transfictional Propulsion Unit and the Book Navigation Protocol. The former we have worked out, the latter is something you need to update us on. It was almost noon the following day, and I was being brought up to speed on the rover's complexities by the brilliant Dr. Worthless, who had thanked me profusely for changing my mind so close to the time before they were to fire themselves off into the unknown. It was the least I could do, I replied, keeping the real reason to myself. There had been an excited buzz among the technicians in the lab that morning, and I had been introduced to more specialists in an hour than I'd met in a lifetime. John Henry Goliath himself was on hand to smooth over any problems we might have, and there had already been a propulsion test. The Austin Rover had been chained to the floor, and the engines had been spooled up. With a deafening roar, the rover had flexed at the chains, while an inky black void had opened up in front of it. The engines had been throttled back, and the void had closed. It didn't have the quiet subtleness of Mycroft's prose portal, but it had certainly been impressive. That had been 3 hours earlier. Right now, we were in the control room, and I had been trying to explain to them just what form the book world takes, which was a bit odd, as it was really only my interpretation of it, and I had a feeling that if they accepted my way, it would become the way. So I was careful not to describe anything that might be problematical later. I spread a sheet of paper on the table and drew a rough schematic of the various genres that made up the book world, but without too many precise locations, just enough for them to get us inside, and then too it was a dark and stormy night, without any problems. The Nothing is a big place, I said, without fear of understatement, and mostly empty. Theoretical storyologists have calculated that the readable book world makes up only 22% of visible reading matter. The remainder is the unobservable remnants of long-lost books, forgotten oral tradition, and ideas still locked in writers' heads. We call it dark reading matter.
Why is so much of it unread and untold?
I shrugged. We're not altogether sure, but we think 98% of the world's fiction was wiped out by the accidental death of an Iron Age storyteller about 3,000 years ago. It was what we call a mass erasure. We wouldn't see anything of that size until human perfidy, fire, and mold wiped out 75% of Greek drama at the CE boundary. The reason I mention it is that navigating through the Nothing could be more treacherous than you imagine. Colliding with the lost work of Aeschylus, or being pulled apart by the Hemingway lost suitcase of manuscripts, could bring your trip to a painfully verbose and incorrectly punctuated end. Dr. Worthless nodded sagely. I drew a rough circle near the maritime adventure, civilian, genre. We think that this area is heavy with detritus from an unknown genre, possibly squid action adventure, that failed to fully form a century ago. Twice a year, maritime is pelted with small fragments of ideas and snatches of inner monologue regarding important invertebrate issues that don't do much harm, but book jumping through this zone has always been a bit bumpy. If we wanted to go from maritime to frontier quickly and easily, we wouldn't jump direct, but go through Western. We talked along these lines for a good 4 hours. It surprised me that I knew so much about the book world without really having had to sit down and learn it. and it also surprised me to what an advanced stage the Goliath book project had progressed. By agreement, they would drop me on page 68 of It Was a Dark and Stormy Night, before slingshotting back to Goliath, then await my return and a debrief before attempting any further travel. I had made my demands clearly when I'd spoken to John Henry the previous evening. They would do this my way or not at all, something that he was happy to agree with. He also proposed some sort of business partnership where I could oversee the whole Austin Rover project and determine in what direction book tourism would go. I still didn't like the idea of it, but if the alternative was the wholesale loss of all the classics through reality book shows, then I'd pretend to go along. I told John Henry we could discuss the precise details upon my return. Throughout the day, I'd been having nagging doubts about cozying up to Goliath despite their entreaties, and in an afternoon rest break, I wandered into the employees' canteen area, where there was a TV showing a program all about the upcoming Pride and Prejudice reality show. "Welcome to Bennett Mania," said a lively young man with painfully fashionable facial hair. He was presenting one of several reality book TV shows that had been rushed onto the schedules to cater to the latest fad. "And our studio panel will be here to give an up-to-date analysis of the book's unfolding drama as soon as it begins. Dr. Necessitar, our resident pseudo-psychologist, will point out the bleeding obvious about the Bennett housemate's progress, and our resident experts will give their opinions and advice on whom should be voted out. But first, let's have a rundown on who our housemates actually are." I stood and stared with a kind of numb fascination as a jaunty tune started up under an annoyingly buoyant voiceover that accompanied artists' impressions of the family. "Mr. Bennett is the father of the clan, and when he's not chastising his younger daughters for their silliness or teasing his wife, he likes nothing better than to sit in his study and conduct his affairs. His wife, Mrs. Bennett, who has a brother in trade and is convinced that her daughters should marry up. This old bunny is highly unstable, prone to panic attacks, and socially awkward, so keep your eyes fixed on her for some seriously good fireworks." The illustration changed to that of the sisters, with each being highlighted in turn as the voiceover described them. "None of the daughters will inherit Longbourn due to the lack of an heir, and the apparent absence of any suitable males in Meryton makes the issue of potential husbands a major concern. Curvaceous, doe-eyed Jane, 22, is the beauty of the family, with a kindly temperament to match. And if Bingley looks at another woman, hold on for the waterworks. Next in line is the thinker of the house, and Mr. Bennett's favourite, Lizzie, who is 20. Wilful, skillful, and adept with words, she is certainly one to watch. Never mind the looks, check out the subtext. Third eldest is Mary, who just likes to read and criticise the rest of them. Dreary and unappealing, and we don't think she'll last long. Kitty and Lydia are the two youngest of the Bennets, and the silliest and most excitable of them all, especially when there's a uniform around, or even the sniff of a party. Impetuous and uncontrollable, these are the two that all eyes will be riveted upon." The music ended, and the annoying presenter came back on screen. "There you have it. 7 Bennets, 1 house, 3 chapters, 1 task, 1 eviction. Bookies are already taking bets as to who's for the bullet. Tune in tomorrow at 11 p.m. with your book in hand to read the housemate's first task as it is set, and join us for the reading of The Bennets Live!" I switched off the set and walked back to the book project lab, all doubts over the wisdom of my actions dispelled from my mind. By 6 that evening, the Austin Rover was primed and ready to go. Although there was seating for 12, the crew was to be only the 4 of us, myself, Dr. Worthless, and 2 technicians, whose sole function was to monitor the systems and collect data. I called Landon before we left and told him I'd be home before bedtime. I didn't see any problems. After all, I'd been prancing around the inside of the book world for near on 20 years, and had faced almost all the terrors that could be thrown in my direction. I felt as safe and confident inside fiction as I did walking down the street in Swindon. I'd turn up at the CFG, reveal Thursday 1 through 4 as an imposter, put everything to rights, and be back in time to take Jenny to her piano lesson. Simple. But if it was that simple, why did my insides feel so leaden? John Henry Goliath came to see us off, and we all shook hands before the door closed and sealed itself with a hermetic hiss. The doctor and the two technicians were too busy to be worried over the risks, something that I felt myself but tried not to show. After a half-hour countdown, Worthless fired up the main reactors, released the handbrake, rang the bell twice, and engaged the gravity engines. And with a mild, tingling sensation, we were somewhere else entirely.